Website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm the credentialized Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now is a great time to join. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give, or you can text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots. We're discussing his new article called Impeding Progress: City's Decades-Old Zoning Policies Stall Project at Historically Black Church. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. So, your new piece talks about the Morning Star Missionary Baptist Church in the Cully neighborhood of Portland and how their plans to reinvigorate the church and create a community space has been stalled by permitting and zoning. So to start out here, what is this project that Morning Star wants to create?
So the church, Morning Star Missionary Baptist Church, is partnered with DePave, a local nonprofit, to change a parking lot in the back of their church into a community green space. They kind of envision this as a place where kids can come and play. There's a daycare that's attached to the church where kids currently play on concrete, and they would like for kids to be able to play on grass. It's kind of a, you know, community space with like trees everywhere, sandboxes, there's like garden with ADA accessible raised garden beds, and just kind of a cool place for people to be able to spend time, but also maybe most importantly as sort of a climate resiliency hub for people in the neighborhood and come there when extreme weather events happen.
And so your article talks about, right, it's called Impeding Progress. Why has this project been stalled?
So the Bureau of Development Services, or BDS, has decided that this needs to undergo what they call a conditional use review, which is something that is intended to, you know, examine certain projects. This kind of happens all the time with development projects, to make sure that the intended use of the space aligns with community standards, neighborhood needs, and make sure that that change doesn't negatively impact the area. So they're fairly routine things for BDS, and some other bureaus are involved as well. But to help kind of determine what the aesthetic of an area is and make sure that they aren't causing any other issues.
So part of this is that Morning Star and DePave say that BDS doesn't actually need to use this process, which has been getting in their way. What is their argument there?
Yeah, there are few arguments here. One of the central points has to do with the date of which the BDS kind of interprets this code. Now, BDS will tell you, Jill Grenda from BDS told me that the city does not interpret the code, it simply applies the code. There's a lot to, you know, kind of talk about there, but in that case, like, In this case, Ted Lab from DePave argues that if the Bureau of Development Services was to use the code from 1960 when the building was built, rather than using 1980s code, which they're currently using, which is when the Cully neighborhood was annexed into the city of Portland, then there would be no need for this conditional use review. It has a lot to do with parking, like a lot of these permitting processes do. And the 31 spaces that they want to remove in order to create this community green space, was put in at the church in 1968. So it wasn't a part of the city of Portland until the 80s. 1968, there was no conditional use review. And so DPAVE argues that they don't actually need to move forward with that if they were to, you know, kind of see it through that lens.
So does that mean there won't be any parking at the church?
It means it'll leave 63 parking spaces rather than the 94 that they have now. The 31 spaces that are back there have never been used by that church since they moved there in 2011.
Well, from what you've described, it sounds like, you know, the Morning Star Project addresses a lot of issues that the city has been pretty vocal about supporting, like climate resiliency, environmental justice, and racial equity. Do those things factor into BDS's decision to pursue this conditional use review?
They don't necessarily take into account those same city goals. In order to sort of change the policy and change those, you know, what it takes for, you know, a conditional use review, what the threshold is to require that, the BDS spokesperson Ken Ray talked to me about that and said it needs to first go through the Bureau of Planning Sustainability. Ken Ray at BDS told me that first it would need to go through the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, then it would go through the Planning Commission, and then it would need to be adopted by City Council if they were to change any of the code. Some of that, it's not really a matter to them of interpretation of whether or not it meets the city's kind of climate resiliency goals.
How burdensome is the conditional use process? What does that put on this project?
Yeah, DPAVE expects this to cost about $7,500, at least for this portion of it, and then also set the project back like 3 to 6 months. So DPAVE is concerned about staffing who are basically ready to go to work. They already broke ground on this project in July. And then also the delay in bringing, you know, a materially like positive impact to the community. A community that is, you know, predominantly a BIPOC and low-income community.
What is BDS's rationale for putting it through this conditional use review process?
BDS basically says they don't interpret the code, it's just what the code is. And since they are removing parking, that is something that meets the threshold of requiring a conditional use review.
Well, you also write in this article that this isn't the first time that Morning Star has been held up by permitting and that something similar happened to them at their old location.
Yeah, in 2007, at a different location, and also in Northeast Portland, but the Morning Star Baptist Church had a fire that hit three buildings on their same property. And in an effort to rebuild that, they were trying to work with the city to rebuild the church and bring it back. This is one of the largest African-American congregations on the whole West Coast at that time. There were like 300 to 500 people every week. And they were trying to get through the city's permitting process. It ended up costing $150,000. And the pastor essentially said, we're not sure we're ever going to be able to do this again here. So they decided to essentially give up on that and then move to the location they're at now in 2011. So they've had some experiences with this that make them kind of, I think at this point, start to wonder if they're just going to have to go through this again.
What would you say is the overall state of Portland's permitting system? You interviewed folks who pointed out that in 2020, it was widely discussed at the city level that the system, the policies, and the zoning codes were racist.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, redlining comes to mind in thinking of how neighborhoods have, you know, become segregated through the decades. And so this is kind of a conversation of how something as sort of banal as you know, city permitting process can actually be a part of, you know, creating outcomes that are inequitable for people. So it is, you know, in a time where, you know, people are talking about a just transition from fossil fuels and resilience in the face of climate change. This is one of those, Katya Reyna is the person I spoke to at DPAVE who was talking about these permitting processes. And you know, anything that's sort of standing in the way of that agency and creating, you know, a better future for people who are disproportionately impacted by climate change and who are on the front lines of that, you know, is something that ends up having, you know, negative impacts on BIPOC communities like the one in Coley.
Where would advocates and activists like to see change in this process?
Well, there are a few opportunities to do this, to be able to change the city zoning code. Of course, that would have to go through a process as well, but there are some recent examples of that, like the recent changes have made it so that churches who have unused parking can demolish up to 50% of their parking lot to create affordable housing in the face of an affordable housing crisis. Ted Lab at DPAVE, you know, thinks that that's actually a great kind of blueprint for how to move forward and change some of the local policies so that people can, you know, kind of city can kind of get out of the way and let neighborhoods do what neighborhoods want to do. It's particularly when it aligns so nicely with so many of the city's publicly stated goals.
What are the takeaways that you hope readers and listeners get from this piece?
I suppose one of the things that can get quite boring is to talk about a city permitting process, but sometimes those nuances are the places where, you know, Black, Indigenous, people of color actually feel in the day-to-day experiences the, you know, racism and racial outcomes more acutely. So the, you know, a Multnomah County snapshot, environmental justice snapshot report from just this year, you know, suggests that community members of color live in less walkable areas with less tree canopy. They live closer to major polluters than predominantly white neighborhoods. And, you know, that report cited research that says Portlanders of color and low-income Portlanders are exposed to high heat and less air conditioning than white populations. So having a church that is, you know, ready to kind of step in and be there for their community when those extreme weather events happen is, you know, seems like a pretty good idea for everybody.
If our listeners are interested in reading this article for themselves, what's the best way for them to do that?
The best way to read Street Roots is to buy a copy from a vendor. They are in your neighborhood. They accept Venmo, cash, and tips. You can also find it at streetroots.org.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything else you wanted to touch on?
No, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. That was Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots speaking with me about his new article. It's called Impeding Progress: City's Decades-Old Zoning Policies Stall Project at Historically Black Church. More information is available online at streetroots.org. My thanks to Jeremiah for sharing with us today. If you like interviews like this, consider supporting KBOO during our fall membership drive. It's very easy to do. kboo.fm/give is the website. You can also donate via text by texting the letters KBOO to 44321. That's KBOO to 44321. We really can't do it without your help, and we thank you. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings. We'll see you next time.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Andrea K. Hendrickson. On Thursday, October 19th, Boom Arts Fall Season begins with Jogging, an immersive solo play performed by internationally acclaimed Lebanese actress Hanan Haj Ali. I got the chance to catch up with Hanan ahead of her Portland debut.
Yes, I'm Hanan Haj Ali, artist and theater maker, researcher, and what else? It's enough.
Yeah, I'm Tracy Cameron Francis, the artistic director of Boom Arts in Portland, Oregon.
Hanan, can you please describe your piece, Jogging, to me?
Yes, I am Hanan. A citizen, a mother, and an actress who jogs every morning early in the streets of Beirut in order to prevent stress and osteoporosis. And while she's doing that, she recalls some hopes, desires, dreams, some characters she wanted to, she always dreamt about doing them. And while she's doing that, she notices the everyday destruction of tangible and intangible heritage of Beirut. And because of a personal dream that she had when she was enduring a personal tragedy in her life, she all of a sudden felt that she's a small part of the monstrous puzzle of Medea. And from that time, she slips into her shoes and she tells the real stories of two other contemporary Medeas in Lebanon who reflect all the Medeas and all the women alike in the world.
I'm wondering if you could talk to me a little bit more about the connections between you and other characters that you embody on stage, including Euripides' Medea, Yvonne, and Zara.
Yes. First of all, why Medea? Because as I say in the play, when my 7-year-old boy, Ali, suffered from a very aggressive cancer, and after some months we couldn't do any good for him and he was suffering a lot of pain, I really desired and wanted, I always was saying to myself, if he dies, he will be relieved from his pain, because it's really unbearable to see a mother couldn't do anything, any good for her boy or her girl when it's coming to suffering. While I was walking, jogging one early morning, and I was in this situation, I suddenly dreamt that while I was jogging, I dreamt that I putting a cushion, a pillow on his face and pressing till he died. And when I realized in the middle of the road what kind of dream I had, I was totally traumatized and tetanized. I couldn't move for a while. And all of a sudden, I felt that I am one parcel of this, as I said, of this monstrous puzzle of Medea. And I began to be crazy about it. I've always dreamt about playing Medea in my career, but since I was a student, I wasn't convinced that a mother could kill her own children, whatever would be the reasons. But I discovered after that dream that I was very naive, and I began avidly and fiercely reading everything about Medea, all the versions from Euripides to Heinrich Müller, to see all the films, all the adaptations, etc. And while I was doing that, I got to know from journals the story of Yvonne, which is a very beautiful, very instructed and civilized woman who married her husband after an exemplary love story. They used to call them the Romeo and Juliet of the town. And she was raising her three daughters with really a lot of care, etc. And people couldn't see any previous sign that could predict what happened later, because one morning they discovered that Yvonne poisoned her three daughters with a fruit salad and whipped cream full of rat poison. And she, before she poisoned herself with the same fruit salad, she recorded a video to her husband explaining why she did that. Her husband was 10 years ago, he immigrated to the Gulf, and he was working with a rich team, a very rich emir who has Arabic horses, who is very rich there. And rumors were telling that maybe he's living a very dissolved life. So nobody knows what was in this video, because the family bribed the responsible of the court and the video was destroyed. And this is what I try to reconstruct myself in the play about Yvonne, and I, at the same time, inviting everyone of the audience to also deconstruct his own version. So I tell the story of Yvonne from my point of view and from the elements that I could gather throughout my research. I was intending to finish the play with the story of Yvonne, but in 2013, a friend of mine that I know very well lost her last child, last boy, in a war, because all our lives are marked by a series of wars. And this woman, Zahra, was big love story with the man of her life. But when she sacrificed everything for him, she left her family, everybody, because they were opposed to her marriage, etc. And she did everything for him. She bought a house, a land, and she taught herself. She became a journalist, and she helped her husband to do the same. And after several years, and after having three children, her husband all of a sudden one day left her for another woman. So she felt at that time that everything collapsed, and nothing deserved her sacrifice apart God. And she, from starting that point, she became adherent more and more to the radical ideology, Islamic ideology, and she was praying God every day to be, if she loves her, to be greater, to be a mother of a martyr, and to and that her three children would be martyrs. And this is how she raised them, and two of them died during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 2006. And at that time, she was in pain, but she was feeling very proud. But when her last children in 2013 was killed by his allies in Syria, because he refused to kill innocent people, they killed him, and they brought his body to his mother, claiming that he's a martyr. But before the corpse arrived to the mother, the boy was able to smuggle, to sneak a letter for his mother, saying, "This is what will happen, mother. They will bring my corpse. They will tell you that I'm not here. But please don't allow them to be heroes on my back. Don't bury me, because I don't want to belong anymore to this land, etc., etc." And from that time, we didn't know anything about Zahra. So the play finishes with a very poignant poem of Warsan Shire, which is a Somali poetess who left herself, her country, Somalia, where it was in severe war, and she immigrated to the UK. Now she's about maybe 35 years old, and she wrote very poignant poems about leaving homes and about immigration. And I finished the play with this poem called Home, which is very, very nice.
Since the implementation of a legislative decree in 1977, all theatrical scripts have to be submitted and reviewed by Lebanon's Bureau of Censorship. The Bureau decides which works can be produced for the public. How has this censorship affected your work as an artist?
Yes, it added new battles on our shoulders, because as you know, an artist had to be totally free. It's totally unacceptable to impose censorship on artistic production or on artistic expression or on whatever our expression, human expression, would be. In 2017, when I wanted to present Jogging, it was for me a dead end. I said to myself, either I don't comply at all and I refuse to submit my script to the Department of Censorship, or I stop do theater, because it's really very insulting. Unbearable and unimaginable to continue to do that. And I took a big risk with my decision, because they could put me by this law in jail. They could impose on me to pay at least €10,000, and they could close forever, the whatever theater could host me. And that's why in the beginning I didn't find any theater that accept to host me, but some of my courageous friends backed me up, and they have a kind of spaces for visual arts, or some garages that they converted to a kind of artistic space. So I could present the play in this kind of alternative spaces.
Earlier you had touched on audience responses in the different locations that you performed in.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit more about how those responses have resembled each other.
Wherever the play went, as I told before, audiences are very, very moved. But this having been said, of course, there are some reactions who are contradictory sometimes from one region to another. And in Lebanon, depending on what ideology people are following in a certain where I play. For example, when I went to a camp in northern Lebanon, and I presented this in front of people who emigrated from Syria and from Palestine, there was a number of Vietnamese women who were attending, and in one scene there are a strong scene in the play where I shout against God, and I ask him to give me justice, because since I'm a believer, he's responsible of me. He cannot leave me lose my three children and stay as a watcher. So I really there is a kind of monologue addressed to God, which is unusual, yeah, to be heard for common people. So at that point, a group of 12 women left shouting. One of them was shouting, "What is this? What it is? This is a blasphemy. We don't want to hear that. Who brought this artist here?" And they left. But of course, I'm used to such. I'm totally awake. I understand them. I'm totally awake with the freedom of expression. So the organizer, the owner of the club which invited me, was very afraid. But I told him, "Don't worry, it's their right. Give me the number of the chief." There was a very strong woman shouting of this woman, and told me, what are you going to do?" I told him, "Don't worry, just give me the number." I waited some days, and I contacted her. I was able to take an appointment with her, because in this milieu, they don't ever refuse to offer you a cup of coffee. And I went, they were all there. I talked to them, we drank coffee together. After the coffee, I read the signs of the coffee to them, and we were able to laugh and to begin to be closer. And at that time, I asked one of them, "Now I can ask you a question." They told me, "Okay, go ahead." Told them, "Do you know the Quran?" One of them said, "Of course we know the Quran." I told them, "Do you know the verse which says, 'Don't approach the prayer'?" She answered, "Yes, but you have to continue it in order to understand the meaning." I told her, how, so tell it completely. She said, don't approach the prayer if you are drunk. So I said to her, "Oh, okay, so you don't understand the meaning of anything unless you finish it, be it a book or a scene or a verse or whatever." She said, "Yes." So I told her, "So when you left the theater in the middle of the scene, you didn't understand the scene, you didn't understand the play, and you left." They said, "Yes, you are right." So I invited them again to come again to Tripoli, because I made it twice or three times in Tripoli, and to be my guests, and they came and they continued the play, and finally they were applauding like really very, very, lot of an enthusiasm, and now they are my friends.
And Hanan, a final question for you. What are some of the misconceptions that you've come across, whether about your work or about the Lebanese diaspora?
Some people, and they are not few, be it foreigners or sometimes Arabs, they think that a woman like me cannot act freely on stage, cannot be as open-minded use her body the way I use it on stage. So there are a lot of misconceptions in general about Arab women and about Arab actresses, and also about women in general, but it's more particularly about Arab women. So this place is a shock. When people sometimes are shocked in the beginning about what I'm doing and how am I moving on stage and what am I saying, and this freedom that I use totally in order to tackle the whole subject.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
We invite you to participate in our brand new public affairs program, Once Upon a Time. Share with us your memories and touchstone events of your life. Join us for our premiere, Friday, October 20th, 11 a.m. to noon, here on KBOO 90.7 FM and available online at kboo.fm. Consuelo is my name, and I will be glad to hear from you and reminisce about your journey. Friday, October 20th, 11 a.m. to noon, Once Upon a Time, live in the air room here at KBOO 90.7 FM.
KBOO's annual fall